This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley. New episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episodes a week early, first on BBC Sounds.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back to women in the past, revisiting the audacious crimes of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Women who are trying to make it in a world made for men. Imagine you're 20 years old and living with your new husband in a tiny room in Brooklyn. It's 1923. You both work hard in your jobs, you in a laundry, he in a garage, but you yearn for the good life you see in magazines and all around you in the shop windows of New York's busy streets. One day, you discover you're pregnant. What lengths would you go to create a better life for your unborn child?
I walked into the store cold as a cucumber, with both my hands in my fur coat pockets and one hand holding the butt of the little automatic hidden in my pocket.
The girl with the bob is right on the job, and in the hold-up clan, she has proved that she, the equal can be, of any bandit man.
We were down and out. We were 1,000 times worse off than we were before we ever started stealing money. It got us nothing. And worse than nothing.
Today, I'm going stateside to delve into the story of Celia Cooney, known as the Bobbed-Haired Bandit. She lives in a working-class neighborhood in Brooklyn, sharing a cramped, furnished room with her husband, Ed. Both born in New York, Ed earns $30 a week at the garage. Celia earns $12 at the laundry. It's difficult to save money on those wages, but they do splash out on an occasional luxury, like a fancy faux sealskin coat for Celia. In September 1923, Celia discovers she's pregnant, and she's not happy about their living situation.
I don't want a room. I want a home. I'm not going to have my baby raised in a little 2x4 hole like I was. He's going to have a home, a decent home.
So they turn to a rather different method of generating income. Armed robbery, targeting small grocery stores and pharmacies. I want to know what makes a woman like Celia Cooney, with a job and a baby on the way, turn to crime. And how much was the mania that surrounded her fueled by the fact that she was a woman with an epic haircut? To help me answer these questions, I am delighted to be rejoined by our guest detective, Emmy Award-winning CBS News correspondent, the legendary Erin Moriarty. Lovely to have you back, Erin.
Thank you, Lucy. It is thrilling to be back. This is a wonderful case about a woman who truly broke with conventions while she broke the law.
New York in the early 1920s is roaring. The city's jazz age is a time of Gatsby-esque glitz and glamour, cultural liberation, and disruption to traditional values, particularly for women. In 1920, the USA gave them the vote. It's also the time of prohibition, when the sale of alcohol was banned in the US. The era's worst-kept secrets were the illicit speakeasy bars and the jazz clubs, where men and women could drink together for the first time. New York City has more than 6 million inhabitants. Landmarks such as the Chrysler Building are being built, but it's a city of contrasts, of extreme wealth and grinding poverty. Many people have very little and are desperate for more. To find out where Celia fits into this contradictory society, we have Pulitzer Prize winner and author Debbie Applegate with us. She's the author of Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the jazz age. Debbie, hello.
Hello, glad to be here.
Lovely to have you. Debbie, can you tell us a bit more about the jazz age? What sort of a world is Celia living in?
It is really a brand new moment in American history. World War I decimates all the great capitals of Europe, leaving New York the biggest, greatest, most economically powerful city in the world. It becomes center of factories, of manufacturing, media, entertainment, finance, everything collects there. And as they collect there, so do immigrants. And it is teeming with every single kind of person, poor and rich. The city is exploding with crime, and there's a lot less respect for the rule of law. So criminals seem glamorous, at least for this period of time.
It's very funny, isn't it, to think of criminals being glamorized like that. I suppose that if you were living in Brooklyn, you might well find that aspirational, because it's very different in Brooklyn as opposed to Manhattan, isn't it?
Manhattan is what we associate with all the glamour. Brooklyn was a working class city. So if you live in Brooklyn, you may feel, as so many did, that you are looking across the river to the great shining city and never perhaps going to get there.
What do we actually know about Celia and her family and her background?
She was born in the Lower East Side in 1903. The Lower East Side was the poorest, most crowded neighborhood in New York City. She's the youngest of eight children. Her father is, to use an old-fashioned phrase, a drunkard. Her mother is a washerwoman who scrubs floors for a living and barely keeps them paying off the one room that they can afford. And she runs away from home at the age of 16.
Oh, my goodness. Well, she meets her husband, Edward, at the cinema, and they court and they marry. And we're both looking at a picture of their wedding here. How would you describe her? I'd say that she looks like rather a sweet young woman.
There is a reason. She is only 20 years old, barely 5 foot tall. He towers over her. She's got a gorgeous bouquet of flowers. She looks extremely happy.
She looks like a movie star. She's absolutely lovely with her little T-bar shoes and her bobbed hair. I imagine here that she's thinking about her new married life, dreaming of a nice house and a family.
One of the things that clearly bothers her as she sets up her new life is that she cannot see a way to get a real home. It's extremely expensive to rent anything more than a single furnished room, which is what she and her new husband are living in. And then, of course, she becomes pregnant, and that changes everything.
So they turn to armed robbery. They decide to commit a holdup, desperate for money. Ed creates a fake number plate to attach to a garage car he's borrowed so they can make a quick getaway. After practicing their script and with three guns between them, they set off driving around Brooklyn to find a target. It's 9:30 p.m. It's a cold Saturday night in early January. The streets are quiet. Celia has her faux sealskin coat on. And then they spot the perfect target, a corner grocery store, open late. Ed pulls up to the curb and leaves the engine running as they both get out of the car.
I walked into the store cold as a cucumber, with both my hands in my fur coat pockets and one hand holding the butt of the little automatic hidden in my pocket. The store was lighted up as bright as day, and there were six clerks in white coats fiddling with stuff on the counters.
At this point, Celia nearly loses her nerve.
Gosh, what a simp I am. They'll laugh at us and throw us out on our necks in the street.
But she manages to stay calm, approaching the counter to ask for a dozen eggs, please. And then, just as the staff member starts to wrap her eggs, Ed walks in and...
Stick them up, quick!
The shop workers obey, and Celia shepherds them into the back of the store.
Honestly, they were exactly like sheep.
They went where we told them, and they stood in a line with their mouths gaping and their eyes popping, looking so silly it made me want to laugh.
While Celia is holding up the staff, Ed is raiding the cash register before they run back into the waiting car, screeching off into the night. After they return the car to the garage and get back to their small room, they lock the door and jam a chair under the latch. They count their loot. It amounts to over $600. That's over $11,000 in today's money. And this is life-changing for Celia and Ed. The story is in quite a few papers, and the headlines are mainly about the novelty of a female bandit. Now, Erin, we know that this is Celia and Ed, but the newspapers and the public have no idea. The one thing the papers do know is that this robber is a woman. As somebody who's reported on a lot of crime, Erin, do you think that the idea of a woman with a gun is still entrancing today?
I do. I would argue that a young woman, particularly seen toting a gun in New York, might even be a little more shocking today. Women still commit less than 10% of robberies, to begin with. And then in New York, it's actually tougher to get a gun today than it was back in the 1920s.
Now, Celia and Ed are just thrilled with their beginner's luck, their success. They move into bigger lodgings and they buy some posh new furniture on credit. But they manage to burn through their money in just 1 week. Their new lifestyle will require more money if they are going to sustain it. So they decide to commit another holdup, and another, and another. Each time they get away with it, but the spoils aren't so good. And each time, Celia's wearing her faux sealskin coat. She's faceless, but she is starting to appear all over the press.
The girl with the bob is right on the job, and in the holdup clan, she has proved that she, the equal can be, of any bandit man.
This only succeeds in riling the police and exciting the press even more.
We'd like to hand it to the bobbed-haired bandit, Enright detectives say. But she of the bob is still on the job and laughs at the cops all day.
Debbie Applegate, what do the newspapers tell us about what's been going on with Celia?
The newspapers are fascinated as this very first story about her very first robbery says. She is well clad and pretty, and she gets all the attention. It is really all about her.
I love the headline, six employees in grocery held up by pretty girl and accomplice. It's definitely the pretty girl who's in charge.
That's right.
The police are having trouble catching her, aren't they, Debbie? Were they putting in a lot of resources?
Every week they put in more resources because every week the clamor in the press grows greater. But the police have no idea what's going on. They are just literally looking around for anyone with bobbed hair who looks suspicious. They just start arresting people who might look like her. And they arrest one poor woman who truly was innocent. And this enrages Celia. She leaves a note with wonderful language. You dirty fish-peddling bums, leave this innocent girl alone and get the right one, which is nobody else but us. We defy you fellows to catch us. The bobbed-haired bandit and companion.
So she's embraced her moniker, her sort of stage name, if you like.
Exactly. So as the police are being more and more ridiculed, the police commissioner puts half, fully half, of the police force on the task of finding poor Celia Cooney.
So half of New York's finest have been made to look fools by one young woman with bobbed hair too. My goodness. What an insult to masculine dignity.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Back with our guest detective, Erin Moriarty. Erin, this media frenzy, I imagine it sounds familiar to you from crime reporting. I guess we still have celebrity criminals today, do we?
I think we do, without question, and the nicknames that go with them. It makes me think about Amanda Knox, who was initially convicted and then acquitted of the murder of her roommate in Italy. And she was referred to quite often as Foxy Noxy. It might have been funny to the writers, but it really damaged the defendant in court. In the case of Celia Cooney, as soon as there was a headline that said the bobbed-haired bandit, that became her identity. So that happened back in 1924, and it's happening today.
Now, Debbie mentioned just then that there was a woman falsely believed to be the bobbed-haired bandit based on descriptions of her appearance. Are you familiar with the fact that eyewitnesses often are inconsistent?
Lucy, that was one of the first things I thought about. And something that we do know today is that when someone is holding a gun, the victims think they're looking at that person's face, but they are not. They are actually looking at the gun, and that really explains why it took so long to be able to really settle on a portrait of this woman.
Nobody also seems to have noticed that she was pregnant. Can you believe that?
Again, they're not looking at her body. They were focused on the hair, the hat, and the gun.
Knowing that the police are close, Celia and Ed decide on one last holdup that should set them up for the rest of their lives. It's a dangerous one. It's right in their backyard. The payroll office at the National Biscuit Company warehouse. On payday, stacks of dollar bills are removed from the safe, ready to distribute to the workers. Celia and Ed prepare diligently. They put their furniture into storage. They check into a hotel under pseudonyms. And they book boat tickets bound for Florida. All they have to do is pull off one last robbery and head for the ship to start their new lives. On the 1st of April, 1924, Celia and Ed hijack a limousine and drive to the biscuit warehouse. Celia enters first, wearing her trademark coat. She asks demurely to see the cashier. When he appears, she hands him an envelope. He opens it, but finds it contains only a blank piece of paper. While he's distracted, Celia draws her gun. And Ed enters the room, brandishing two more pistols.
It all came so quick. When we pulled our guns, the girls all ran, and the men threw up their hands.
Celia and Ed try to take control, ushering the employees into another smaller room. But the cashier lunges for Celia, and she falls over. The cashier gets away into the next room. And in a panic, Ed takes aim and fires at the door.
God, I must have croaked him.
Ed has shot, but mercifully only wounded the cashier. Not knowing if he's alive or dead, Celia and Ed make a run for it. In their panic, they leave behind $8,000 in the open safe. Erin, they've just abandoned $8,000. That's nearly $150,000 in today's money.
I don't think they ever anticipated that something would go wrong like this. And I think at that moment, all either one of them wanted to do was just get away.
1920s New York was full of inequality. What's the situation in the city today, Erin? Better or worse?
Oh, it's really not that much different. And I think a perfect example of a case just right now in New York, it involves a young man who stalks and on video seemingly kills a CEO of a major insurance company. And, you know, readers can't get enough of this story. They want to know who this person is. He turns out to be this very handsome young man. And on the surface, a very unlikely killer. And it takes on a life of its own. And sadly, one of the results is that people are far more interested in knowing more about the alleged perpetrator than they are about the victim. It's one of the reasons, actually, that we are not covering the story at this moment, because we are concerned that a case like this turns the alleged killer into a folk hero.
Back to the 1920s. Celia and Ed do make it to Florida, but they are racked with guilt about shooting the cashier at the biscuit factory, and they are also destitute. With nothing to show for their final holdup, they have once again run out of money.
We were down and out. We were 1,000 times worse off than we were before we ever started stealing money. It got us nothing, and worse than nothing.
On the 10th of April, Celia gives birth, but tragically, just 2 days later, the baby dies. Thanks to a tip-off from one of the couple's former neighbours, the police finally track the couple down. They bring Celia and Ed back to New York to stand trial. Celia is now a huge celebrity. A massive crowd gathers to greet the train at Grand Central Station. While they're in prison awaiting their trial, Celia sells her story to a magazine. She gets $1,000. This article is where Celia's words have come from throughout this episode. But the story was in fact ghostwritten by a young male journalist. Celia tells him the story and he writes it up in the first person. You can read all about this in an excellent book about the case by Stephen Duncombe and Andrew Matson. Now, we have some pictures of this photo shoot in prison, Erin. She looks so young, doesn't she?
She looks so pixie-ish. You know, she is so tiny, and there's such an incongruity between what she's accused of doing and how she looked. That is what strikes me. Even when she is photographed holding this tiny gun in her hand, and she has a very determined look on her face, but she still looks to me like she's play-acting, like it's a toy gun.
This business of Celia selling her story, could that still happen today? Is that allowed?
It used to be far more common. Today, I think that is far less likely because your stories are suspect if you're paying people to tell you details of it. And then many states also have what we call Son of Sam laws. There was a criminal back in the 70s who had the nickname, of course, another nickname, Son of Sam. And he tried to benefit from his story, and that was prevented with new laws. So it's rare for a defendant, particularly one who is convicted of the crime, to have any kind of financial benefit from that crime.
I'm getting the impression from this posing for photos that Celia does kind of like the attention. What do you think?
I think she did. She liked how she dressed. She wanted people to look at her. I think she would have been an influencer today. So there's no question in my mind that she enjoyed the attention, but probably didn't enjoy the consequences.
Good way of putting it. Back to the story. Celia and Ed stand trial, pleading guilty to a charge of assault and armed robbery. They're each sentenced to a maximum of 20 years in prison, in Auburn Prison in upstate New York. Celia now flourishes. She learns nursing, she attends cookery classes, and she makes regular use of the library. She even plays, get this, on the women's prison baseball team. She and Ed get released on parole in 1931 after 7 years in prison. While they've been inside, the world has changed. The Empire State Building has gone up, but the stock market has crashed down. The Great Depression is in full swing. But Celia and Ed are quite well set up. They were given a sum of money in compensation for an injury Ed received in prison. They have two sons, Pat and Ed Jr. And Celia once again dreams of a nice house. In 1936, though, Ed dies, thrusting Celia right back down to where she began. Living in poverty in New York City, this time as a single mother with two children to support. Celia ends up living a long life, eventually relocating to Florida, where she'd always dreamed of living. And in the final days of her life, in 1992, her two sons start to discover the truth about their mother, the bobbed-haired bandit. We have a final special guest, one who can tell us much more about this last chapter of Celia's story. In A Lady Swindler's First, we're joined by a family member of Celia's, Kat Palmiotti. Welcome, Kat.
Thank you.
Now, tell me, how are you connected to Celia and Ed Cooney?
Well, Celia and Ed are my grandparents. They're my father's parents. So we didn't call Celia the bob-haired bandit. We called Celia Grandma.
And your father, am I right, he never knew that he was the son of the bobbed-haired bandit?
My father never knew. She was just Mom.
And how did it all come out?
So my dad and his younger brother grew up with Grandma in New York, and they basically had a normal childhood. My grandmother and my uncle, Ed, both wound up in Florida. And she had unfortunately gotten Alzheimer's as she got older. And one day she was in the car with my uncle and she started saying some kind of strange things and said, Eddie, don't let them get me. The coppers, I'm the bob-haired bandit. And he settled her down and they went on, you know, through the rest of their day. And after she had passed away, he started thinking about that conversation and thought it sounded really strange. So he started researching Celia Cooney. And the very first photo he found was her getting arrested.
Oh, my goodness. Now, this is your grandmother we're talking about. So can you give us a sense of what she was like?
I remember her as being really well-dressed. She always had jewelry on, had perfume on. She gave us gifts and read books with us and did grandma things.
Oh, well, obviously, she wasn't going around doing any secret armed robbing at that stage in her life, but she had a wonderful ability to keep her secret, didn't she? What's these pictures that we've got here?
One is my grandma with her three grandchildren. I'm on the left.
Yeah. And she's reading you a story. She could not look more grandmotherly with her spectacles on and the kids clustering around.
Absolutely.
She looks like the absolute diametric opposite of an armed robber, doesn't she?
She does.
I've learned so much about Celia during this episode, and it's just extraordinary to meet her granddaughter, Kat, which is you. It's like coming face to face with history.
I would like her to be remembered as a strong woman who wanted what's right for her family. And actually, kind of a funny aside is that my dad wound up being a police officer, which is as far from Mom's history as you could get. And I am incredibly proud that she turned it totally around and didn't even let anyone know that she had done this. So I have to give her huge kudos.
So, Erin, what do you take away from the story of the bobbed-haired bandit?
I think it's significant that Celia never told anyone about her background, so she clearly wasn't proud of it. All Celia wanted to do was improve her lot in life, and simply by virtue of her sex and perhaps even her economic background and class, she found that crime might be the best option. That's sad to me.
One thing I take from this story is that it's a good idea to search for your grandparents' names online in case they have a secret past. Celia kept her secret because, although she tried to get it in an unconventional way, her dream life was utterly conventional. It was being a wife and a mother in a lovely home. The press frenzy around Celia's case makes it hard to find the truth, but her story reveals New York's anxieties in the 1920s. Young women were more prominent in society. Prohibition made guns and male gangsters highly visible. Give a flapper a gun, and you get a perfect media storm. 100 years on from Celia's case, I'd like to think there's a bit more gender equality. But I suspect that we might still be just as entranced if a female armed robber came along, especially if she had really great hair. Well, a huge thank you to Erin Moriarty, Kat Parmiotti and Debbie Applegate. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we're joined by comedian and author Deborah Frances White for some bold conversations. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Laurel Lefko and Jonathan Keeble. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with Lady Swindlers weekly on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is Dr. Chris.
And Dr. Zand here, and we are dropping in to let you know about our new BBC Radio 4 podcast.
In What's Up, Docs, we are going to be diving into the messy, complicated world of health and well-being, because it can be confusing, can't it, Zand?
That's right, Chris. The mass of information out there can be contradictory, it can be overwhelming, and Chris and I get confused too.
That's right. We get seduced by the marketing, the hype, the trends, so we want to be your guides through it. And I think it's fair to say, Zand, we are going to be getting personal.
We're absolutely going to be getting personal, Chris. What I want to do is bring in my own health dilemmas in the hope that we can help you with yours.
Listen and subscribe to What's Up, Docs on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.